Calls for Action presents Of Consuming Interest, a public service show that discusses scams, deceptive offers, and other consumer concerns. Here's Call for Action's president and your host, Shirley Rooker.
Diet and exercise can help protect your heart, but what do you know about them? Are there good fats and bad fats? Should you eat carbs? And if so, what kind? Do supplements have a role in heart health? And what about exercise? What type and how intense? Well, we're going to discuss all this and more. My guest is Dr. Richard Rubin. He's a cardiologist in private practice in Chevy Chase, and he's also the chief of cardiology at Sibley Hospital. Dr. Rubin, welcome to Of Consuming Interest.
Hi, Shirley. Nice to be back with you.
Now, I should tell our listeners that you are my cardiologist and that I did have a heart attack in April and that I am doing well, I think. At any rate, I'm delighted to have you here because I find that there's so many things that I learn as I go about the process of healing and keeping myself healthy. About diet, about fats, the whole subject can be, I think, extremely confusing. So let's start off with the subject of fats, which I gather have a significant role in heart health. Tell us about it.
Surely in our diet, we have three major constituents. We have protein, we have carbohydrate, and we have fats. And the fats in particular are capable of working their way into the wall of your artery and causing a blockage. So when we ask people to limit their fat, we ask them to read the food labels, which are very helpful. They've been around for several years. And to limit their intake of not only total fat, but saturated fat.
Okay, so saturated fat, define that for us. I mean, what would that be? Yeah. What would I find? Is that lard? Is it canola oil, olive oil? How do I figure out all this? I know I can read it on the label, but when I'm going to the grocery store and if I don't really do a good job of reading labels, what do I need to know?
Well, without going into too much of a chemistry lesson, saturated fat is a complete molecule of fat which will not go around and pick up or scavenger and remove fat. But unsaturated fat, particularly polyunsaturated fat, actually is an incomplete molecule. So as it travels through the body, it picks up other pieces of fat to try and complete itself, and then that can be delivered for excretion from the body, elimination.
Oh, so that's a useful kind of fat. That's the good fat we hear about.
Polyunsaturated is the good fat.
Is that like olive oil for one?
Yes. Now, I must say that we want to cut down on our total fat. So even if we're eating good fats, we don't want too much fat. But your fat in preference should be the so-called good fats. And most people think of olive oil as in the Mediterranean diet and fish oil as in our cold water fishes, salmon, herring, mackerel, and cod. To the extent that you're going to have fat in your diet or cook with fat, olive oil and the fish oils are the preferred fats.
So, but I've never heard of cooking with fish oils. But in terms of consumption or as a supplement, which we're going to talk about later, would that be how you would get the fish oils or eating the fish?
Yeah, fish oil, interestingly enough, comes from algae, the plants, which are way down the food chain. And the little fish eat the algae and the big fish eat the little fish. And the fish oil winds up in the fish, but it actually comes from algae. And what we commonly call fish oil are actually two chemicals called DHA and EPA. So we're eating fish in an attempt to get those chemicals. Technically, you could eat algae to get those chemicals, and maybe someday, rather than eat the fish, we'll farm it from the algae. Some people are concerned about toxins in fish like mercury, and as a result of that, people are thinking about trying to get the fish oil as low down the food chain as possible.
So the total fat is very important. That's very significant, right?
We don't want a large amount of total fat. And within our fats, we want as much as possible the healthy fats and not the saturated fats and not the trans fats.
Okay. And total fats, because first off, it contributes to calories. Is that part of the reason?
Yes. Human beings, we are all descended from human beings who were efficient at storing calories. You know, in order to live through the winter in the old days when there was famine and food shortage, you'd have to store calories. And we all know that men store calories predominantly around their middle as fat, and women tend to store it in their thighs as fat. And those are extra calories for a rainy day. Well, there's no more famine now in this area where we're living today. And so we don't want that fat storage. We can sort of go with a just-in-time calorie delivery. You only need to eat what you need to get you to your next meal. We don't need that 10 or 20 pounds of stored fat.
Now, there's some talk about trans fats because that is required to be on the label of foods. But if it's less than a half a gram, a milligram, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be reflected. It can be shown as zero trans fats. There are products that have 0.05, I guess, or 0.49 trans fat content. Some people are saying that even 2 milligrams of trans fat is too much.
Yes. The American Heart Association has identified that we want to keep ourselves below the 2 gram level for trans fat.
2 gram. Am I putting this correctly? When it's 0.5, that's a half a gram.
Half a gram.
Okay.
And the lower the better. Now let's talk about what trans fats are. And once again, without getting into a chemistry lesson.
Sure.
Trans fats are an artificial fat that were invented to give food more shelf life. Everyone wants the product to last on the shelf for 4 or 5 or 7 days without going bad. They're invented to give more mouthfeel. When you taste something and you say, oh, that's creamy or it's buttery, that's what trans fats were used for. And last but not least, when you fry food like a French fry or the way a donut is made, it increases the ease of frying in an industrial sense, in a product production sense. But they're not healthy. And it was discovered in the 1990s that those can raise your LDL or bad cholesterol, and they can lower your HDL or good cholesterol. So in the 2000s, there was a campaign to eliminate trans fats. It does so happen that some natural foods, natural proteins and carbs and vegetables, contain a little bit of trans fat. So what we know is that we want to keep the amount to a minimum and that it does not have to be 0.0, but there are certainly levels that are unhealthy. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and so we do need to be aware of it and aware that it's there. And actually, part of the way you learn that is by reading the food labels to see what it actually contains.
Absolutely. You have two very important allies. One is the food levels now specify trans fat, and you'd like to get as close to zero as possible. And number two is a lot of our political jurisdictions are banning trans fat in the food preparation. Mm-hmm. So the companies are out there looking for ways to make French fries and donuts and off-the-shelf pastry products without trans fat.
Well, that's a good thing, I think, a very good thing. What about the role of carbs? You know, we hear so much about, oh, you shouldn't eat this carb, you shouldn't eat that carb. There's got to be something wrong with this. I love my fruit.
Mm-hmm. Now, if fat is our energy storage vehicle, carb is our immediate energy vehicle. So the carbs that you eat, the carbohydrates, will be used for energy. And, of course, we all need energy. So the grams of carbohydrates that you take in, whether it comes from fruits or vegetables or the traditional carbs, bread, rice, pasta, cereal, potatoes, you use those for energy. What you have to do is have a sense of how much you need to get you to the next feeding. If you eat extra carbs, they'll be stored as fat. The body will convert them into fat and store them, as I said before, around your middle or wherever you happen to store fat. It takes about 3,500 extra excess calories ingested to store a pound of fat. So if you think about it, if you have a few extra cookies per day or an extra donut or an extra latte with cream in it, then you will eventually accumulate those 3,500 extra calories, and your body will store them where it's going to store them.
So unfortunately, they add up pretty fast, don't
they? They do, and we don't tend to burn them off. So we need to think about portion control. We need to think that when we sit down in front of carbohydrates, which we use for energy, they are not evil. We need them for energy, but we need to eat a reasonable amount.
Let's just identify ourselves. You're listening to Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Dr. Richard Rubin. He's a cardiologist in private practice in Chevy Chase, and he's the chief of cardiology at Sibley Hospital. And we're discussing the factors that make up a healthy heart, which includes diet and exercise and all kinds of good stuff. All right, going back to the subject of carbs. So we have carbs. What about the people who say you should avoid the high fructose corn syrup, that is a definite no-no? Is that any worse than eating carbs in other forms?
Yeah, you know, the most natural form of the carbs would be the less processed food. When you go with the high fructose corn syrup, you're probably into a sort of an artificial product where the sweetening has been hyped. And don't forget also that when they take fat out of foods and they don't want to lose the flavor, they may add carbs to replace the fat. So a fat-free cake may have a lot of extra sugar in it. High fructose corn syrup is most commonly found in soda pop. And it's a very nutritionally empty form of calories.
Not a great way to nourish your body and keep your calories both at the same time.
Now, portion control is very, very important. We've been tricked by marketeers a little bit into making these questions, which are really false choices. You know, is a foot-long sub for $4.99 a good value? But if you sit with a nutritionist, they'll say, you don't need a foot-long sub. You need a 6-inch sub. People will also ask us the big gulp, the 32-ounce soda, which may be made with high fructose corn syrup. Is that a value for only 99 cents? Well, that's another false choice. You should be really drinking water,
right,
preferentially, maybe fruit juice diluted with water. And, you know, we really want to stay away from the empty calories like soda.
It's all about the bottom line, isn't it? It's just like your bank account. It's the bottom line, the amount of calories you consume, but also the components of heart health are important in that amount of calories.
Yes, you know, we're fighting marketing in several senses. We've been in a society now that snacks, you know, it's no longer the three meals. There's the in-between meal coffee or the in-between meal snack, and then also portion size is controlled now a lot by marketeers. If you've ever been to the movies, all three sizes of popcorn are gigantic. So you have to be very mindful of portion size.
Okay. All right. So here we are looking at the components of diet. Where do proteins fit into all of this, and what part do they play in heart health?
Proteins are the building blocks of our body. The structures of our body are, in essence, fabricated from proteins. But we want to have the proteins that are lean. And we all know that chicken and fish are lean. What people may not know is that farm-raised free-range beef or very lean beef like a filet mignon can also be lean and relatively low in fat. Most people rotate their proteins between the fish and the chicken and the lean beef. We need to trim off visible fat. So if you come into the store and you buy a lamb chop or a pork chop, and you should always be trimming off the visible fat. And yes, when food looks marbled, which means you can see the fat in there between the protein, that may make it taste a little more juicy, but you have to limit, you know, the marbling and the obvious visible fat.
I'm fond of pork tenderloins, mm-hmm, which are extremely lean.
Right.
And although I find that when I do lean cuts of beef that I marinate them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you want to be careful that the oil that you marinate them in, that you drain off the excess oil, and you want to use a healthier oil,
yeah,
or mm-hmm, maybe you'll be marinating them in spices or mm-hmm something of that mm-hmm nature. So you want to be careful that when you're choosing your protein that you don't inadvertently also choose fat. So when you're thinking of a bologna or a salami or a hot dog as your protein or tuna fish mixed up with mayonnaise, you may have had a good intention with the tuna fish, but now that you've added the mayonnaise, you're adding the fat in there. So most people are aware that chicken and fish are a good starting base. And when you talk about pork and beef, they're okay if they're lean, trimmed, and also, once again, a reasonable portion size.
I learned something. We're not going into a cooking class here, but if you're using a really lean cut of beef, which can be tough, if you use kiwi in the marinade, it breaks down the enzymes in kiwi. I'm mm-hmm teaching you something.
Yes.
It breaks down the whatever it is in the meat and mm-hmm makes it tender. And
yes,
you have to be careful you don't over-tenderize it. But you can combine it with marinades, and mm-hmm it's wonderful.
Fabulous points about ways to cook to mm-hmm increase tenderness without marbling fat. So, for example, if somebody shows you a ribeye steak, there's a lot of marbled fat, but that's really not good for you. How else can you get that juiciness and tenderness without mm-hmm the fat? Braising, which is slow cooking for
sure,
a long time, marinating, as you mentioned, with the kiwi. So let's look for ways to be tender and juicy without adding fat.
You didn't know you'd get a cooking lesson today.
That's fabulous.
I found this online, and I tried it with a very lean cut of beef. It was awesome because the meat tenderized in about 2 hours rather than having to do it overnight. So listeners out there, cooking class is going on. So the proteins are a very important component of our diet. Okay, so we covered diet pretty well. I think the empty calories we want to avoid. Mm-hmm. What about alcohol? I'm fond of a glass of wine. Please tell me it's okay.
There are studies that show that people who drink approximately one alcoholic beverage a day actually live a little longer than people who don't drink at all.
And they enjoy it more.
And they enjoy that one beverage. But you have to be careful because as you go up to 2, 3, 4, there is a higher risk, particularly of cancer.
Especially with breast cancer in women.
Exactly. And whether or not you can have one a day or two a day safely depends upon your body weight. So a 6-foot man who weighs 180 pounds maybe can have almost two drinks. But a woman who's 5 feet and 100 pounds really has to go to one. And those health benefits of alcohol probably come from antioxidants in the alcohol.
Mm-hmm. So you may be able to get some of those even from products like grapes.
Yes, but you don't have to do it in an alcoholic beverage.
Right.
The antioxidants are predominantly found in the colored skins of the fruit, like the fruit of a blueberry, raspberry, mm-hmm. the thing that would stain your white sweater if it got on there.
Gotcha.
And that's where the antioxidants are. So if you do
and they're
not
delicious blueberries.
Oh, I'm if wondering. You don't want to drink alcohol, you can eat some blueberries. You can drink some grape juice. You mm-hmm. know, you do not have to have it's not the alcohol per se. It's the antioxidants.
It's what's contained in there. But I think, you know, a lot of people do enjoy a glass of wine, but you're right. It has to be part of the total picture. So, well, let's just take a brief pause here to let our listeners know that they're tuned in to Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Dr. Richard Rubin. He's a cardiologist in private practice in Chevy Chase, and he's the chief of cardiology at Sibley Hospital. And we're talking about all the things that make up heart health. Now, there's a big part of this that we haven't discussed yet, which is exercise.
Absolutely.
And that is, I'm sure, gets equal weight with diet in terms of heart health, or at least I would think it did.
You know, our patients, particularly at this time of year when they're renewing their prescriptions, they focus on their medication. But the lifestyle modifications we're talking about today, diet and exercise, have power equal to medication. Somebody who maintains a healthy diet is about as equal to a medication, and if you have a exercise program. So if you're looking to pare down your medicine list, if you're thinking about expense for medicine at this time of year, diet and exercise may help you to shorten your medicine list. And exercise, without any doubt, not only has cardiac benefits, it has musculoskeletal benefits. It has mental health benefits.
Sure does. It relieves
it helps
stress.
You sleep, relieves mm-hmm. stress. So we can't say enough about exercise.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the types. Now, I have to tell you, it's a little daunting for somebody to tell me that I have to exercise a half an hour every single day of my life. What is a realistic program?
Yes.
I mean, you know, I have other things that I do. I try to walk a good bit, but that's not mm-hmm. really cardio. I mean, it's just, all right, I walk around the grocery store trying to find non-fat foods or healthy foods. But at any rate, what are the components of an exercise program that are going to give me health benefits and yet at the same time fit into a lifestyle that includes an awful lot of other stuff?
Now, most people think of exercise nowadays in three different categories. You have the aerobic exercise, and then you have the strength training, and then you have the stretching and flexibility. All of them are important. I think we should start with aerobic exercise because mm-hmm. that has the most direct cardiac benefit. The interesting thing is your heart and blood vessels don't actually know what you're doing. So what they see is they see increased flow through the vessels and increased work for the heart, and that tones up those organs. But the heart and blood vessels, they don't have their own brain center there, so they don't know if you're playing basketball or riding a bike or swimming, or perhaps you're brisk walking. What they see is the flow. So you'd like to stick to something that you like because the heart is indifferent to what you're doing. And the most important variable is duration, the number of minutes per week you do it. After duration, then you might consider later on adding some intensity.
What about duration now? Yeah. I mean, are you going to tell me that I have to do this every day of my life?
No, there's a curve for benefit versus duration. And the first thing I'd like to say is anything is better than nothing. So
right.
even if you are only walking your dog or only walking to the metro or just walking around your office on purpose, that's better than nothing. So nobody should discourage you that you have to do at least 30 minutes. Nobody should discourage you in that way. So anything is better than nothing. And if all you can do is walk the dog, we'll take it. But the curve for benefit keeps getting higher and higher until you reach about an hour a day. Once you're doing an hour a day, it levels off. So the people who may have time or interest in doing 2 or 3 hours a day of exercise, they're not really tripling or quadrupling their benefit. It does mm-hmm. level off eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But as you go from 0 to 60 minutes a day of aerobic activity, you do get incremental benefit. Most people would recommend about a half an hour a day as a, something that's easily achievable by a busy person with a job and children and other responsibilities. In that 30 minutes, be sure to include a couple of minutes at the beginning and a couple of minutes at the end for a warm-up and a cool-down. The body does not like sudden load, sudden stress. That's a good way to tear your Achilles tendon or pull a hamstring or, God forbid, rupture an artery. So we want to devote the first 2 or 3 minutes to warming up and the last 2 or 3 minutes to cooling down. And then in between, there's that nice, juicy 25-minute segment when you can increase your efforts.
Now, we're talking about aerobic there.
Aerobic exercise.
Okay, so ideally, this is something you should be doing every day. All right, how do you combine that with strength training and the flexibility? I mean, that's that's a no-brainer.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned.
We should be doing that almost every single day, I'm sure.
Yeah, you mentioned every day. In order to make progress, in order to feel yourself getting more and more fit as the months go by, 3 times a week will probably allow you to make progress.
Mm-hmm.
Twice a week will tend to allow you to feel like you're staying the same.
Mm-hmm.
And 0 to 1 time a week, you'll gradually lose your fitness. So the most common thing that people will recite to me that they've heard before is 30 minutes 3 times a week. And where that comes from is that's what you need to make some progress.
Yeah. So that is as a minimum. If you add on to that,
as you get up to an hour a day,
training, and that would be part of your hour. If you do half an hour of strength training and a half an hour of aerobics,
right,
that's giving you an hour 3 times a week. So, which is much better than a half an hour 3 times a week. So,
great way to use your hour: 30 minutes with the aerobics we just discussed, and then use the other half hour on stretching and strength. Now, you have to be careful with strength training because you must use proper form. So it's a good idea to have somebody who knows what they're doing, perhaps the trainers in a health club or a friend who's familiar with it, show you the proper way to work with weights. And of course, weights come in free weights or they come in the incorporated into machines where they're already stacked up for you. But you must use proper form to avoid injuring yourself.
Well, now I have a knee problem and I find it difficult to walk really fast or to jog. Matter of fact, that's impossible. So what I do on the treadmill is I do an incline.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep increasing the amount of the incline. And I found that that has helped me a lot, and yet it allows me to walk slowly, but at the same time to get cardiac benefits from it.
The world is trying to help people with specific problems, knees and hips and shoulders, trying to help them exercise. So when you see newer machines like the recumbent bicycle where you're sitting down but pedaling with your legs extended, or the elliptical where you're on a pendulum-like device with seemingly no friction, those are efforts to take the strain off the knees or the hips so that everyone can exercise. And I think, once again, if you go to a proper exercise store where there are people to guide you, or you ask your physician, or if you have a physical therapist, if you've ever been involved with a specific sports injury, they can guide you to a machine and an exercise that's appropriate for you.
Mm-hmm.
And as our population ages, we have many people who need exercise who have knee and hip problems, but they're not disqualified because they've invented these alternative machines. Right?
You can do a lot aerobically with just increasing the incline or things of that nature. We only have another minute. I can't believe the time has flown by. We really didn't talk too much about supplements. We did talk about fish oil and vitamin D. Is there anything else that we should add in there?
Well, this is a place where supplements have come and gone over the years, and there's a difference between reading it as a testimonial in a magazine and knowing that there's been a study done on it. And the supplement that seems to be most promising at the moment that has had research worked on it is fish oil. And I would say in second place right now is vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things we've tried in the past, like giving everyone vitamin E and vitamin C and folic acid, have not panned out as well as we've hoped. So right now the two leading supplements are fish oil and vitamin D.
And stay tuned. We'll talk about those at another time. Thank you so much for being here. It's been very informative and encouraging to know that there are many options available to us. You have been listening to Of Consuming Interest right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest has been Dr. Richard Rubin, a cardiologist in private practice in Chevy Chase. I'm Shirley Rooker, and thank you for joining us.
Of Consuming Interest is a public service program presented by Call for Action, hosted by Shirley Rooker. Call for Action is an international nonprofit network of hotlines which offer free and confidential assistance. If you have a complaint, contact Call for Action at 301-652-HELP. That's 301-652-HELP.